This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Growing up in Garner, John Powell stayed out of trouble, even when he dropped out of ECU, found a good job with Carolina Power. His first encounter with the criminal justice system was after he'd gone to night school at NC State, graduated, and gone to law school at Campbell University. As a criminal defense attorney, he represented kids, the same kids, over and over again. And after a while, his faith that the juvenile justice system could rehabilitate offenders was so low that he returned to his religious faith to find a new path. The result was a juvenile justice project at Campbell Law School. John Powell runs it, and he uses a restorative justice model to keep kids out of the criminal justice system, and he hopes out of his office forever. John Powell joins me in the studio now. John, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much, Frank.
You were a defense attorney representing kids. Who were these kids? What kind of trouble were they getting into?
Well, you get a pretty wide variety within the juvenile justice system. A lot of it is school fights that come out of arguments in school that may have started with conflict at home and that sort of thing. But it goes all the way up. I mean, you can have the most serious of cases within the juvenile system. However, in the state of North Carolina, we have statutes that are in place that take the most serious offenses and place them directly into our adult system.
And kids are tried as adults at 16. So,
right. We don't have a system to take a 16-year-old and place them back in the juvenile system in North Carolina. As soon as they turn 16, if they're charged, they're in our adult system.
So what was your frustration with the system?
Well, as you've said in your intro, representing some of the same kids over and over again until I saw them being taken away from their families, being placed in secure custody. And that's what our penal system does. It takes you out of your community. It isolates you within an institution. And that's a very, very sad thing to see a 13, 14, 15-year-old child wind up in that situation. As an attorney who really wants to make a difference in people's lives, when you see that happen, you feel like you have utterly failed that person.
And you said at a certain point you could see a pattern and just sort of count the number of offenses until they were out. It's a process.
Well, the way the statute is written, it's a number system. So each time they are convicted, they have a number that's attached to that conviction. And once they get to a certain number, the judge has no discretion in that. The judge has to place them in a youth development center.
What was your sense going in? What is it you thought you were going to do for these kids in this system?
I guess, naively, I thought that I had the skill set to sit them down in my office and have some conversation, and it was going to make a difference. And for some, it does make a difference, Frank. We're not talking about a huge majority of kids that are taken out of their homes and isolated, but we are talking about a significant number. I thought, as an attorney and as a counselor at law, and that word counselor is more important to me than attorney, that I could make a difference by sitting down with them and their families and having that conversation, and they would take a different path. But I learned that that really wasn't true.
So tell us about this, a juvenile justice project that you have now. How did that come about? How did this new way of coping with the problem come to your attention?
There was a new criminal law professor at Campbell Law School where I had gone to school. His name was Tony Baker. He and I met one day at a seminar. I had been practicing law for a number of years. I had been certified as a civil superior court mediator, but primarily my practice was within criminal defense. And just over coffee one morning, he was trying to understand a little bit about who I was, and I was getting to know him. And when he heard the criminal defense and when he heard the mediation, he said, "I have dreamed of a clinic in a law school where we would bring criminal defendants together with their victims, and we would create rules that allow that to happen, and we would practice it under a restorative justice model." And I thought he was nuts. I said, "You know, defendants have a right not to talk." And as a criminal defense attorney, that was usually my advice to them. However, I was a part of that system that was leading to my own frustration, because if we cannot have communication, we cannot solve our problems.
So what did you know much about restorative justice until then?
I knew nothing about it. Right. I had a concept in my mind, and often I would say to the prosecutor in the juvenile court, "Can't we just talk about this?" That was my default position as a person who wanted to help people solve their own problems. It's very difficult within our system to be able to do that because anything that you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. So without protections, you really cannot talk to people.
So that's what we have. We've got this adversarial system, as you say, it's set up. Everybody's going to bring their best case. In your case, if you're a defendant, just shut up, because right. the less you say, the better. You certainly don't want to acknowledge guilt, even if you've done it. That's the right. last thing you want to do.
Right.
Restorative justice, and I'll ask you to explain this a little bit, takes the other approach and says, no, you really need to come to terms with and embrace your guilt, acknowledge your guilt, and work with the victim who really wants to hear what you have to say about your part in this.
That's exactly what restorative justice is about. And that's a hard pill for people to swallow who have never been exposed to that concept. And it was hard for me to swallow. It was hard for me to get my head around how I could let my clients do that. And so what it takes is a set of local rules that supply confidentiality in those settings where you can admit your wrongdoing, especially if you're entering into a restorative dialogue prior to your adjudication, because normally prior to adjudication, anything that you say can be used against you. So we did create local rules within our district court system where these kids were going into that allowed them to freely admit their wrongdoing. And I think that is a very important first step to get to accountability. Now, the traditional system says that one of its purposes is to hold defendants accountable, and it does that through punishment. There is a huge difference, though, in the subsequent behavior if a person can hold themselves accountable instead of being held accountable. And to me, from the offender's side of restorative justice, that is the most important part of it. They can hold themselves accountable for what they have done and change their behavior.
And I've often heard it said that restorative justice is a victim-centered process. It really focuses on a victim in the way that our criminal justice system doesn't.
Right. Our criminal justice system, out of necessity, is focused on the offender. It looks at what the offender has done. It adjudges if the offender is guilty, and then it determines what the sentence is that will be imposed upon the offender. It is not a system that is designed to pay attention to the victim's needs. So I don't necessarily fault our system for not being able to do something that it is not designed to do.
Yeah, but what good is it to the victim to hear a guy say, yeah, I did it. Yeah, I broke into your house. I took your stereo, and I made off with your car.
In a restorative context, it can make all the difference in the world. Victims come in with a lot of needs. If you consider that your home has been broken into, then you have been invaded by someone and you don't even know who it is most of the time. There's an awful lot of trauma that comes with that. There's an awful lot of fear. You may have a great fear of even walking back in your house again. So in a restorative setting, to be able to sit down and see the person that has done it, to be able to hear them, for them to be able to hear from you, to be able to approach each other on a very human level, it's amazing to see how some of those needs can be met simply by sitting down at the table and having that conversation.
Now, this is a crime we're talking about, and using restorative justice in that model. But I also heard you say mediation, and right. when you use it, say, in a junior high school, there might be other applications as well.
Absolutely. And I appreciate that distinction because there is a distinction, and it's an important distinction. In the restorative justice model, it is victim-centered such that the victim, especially in more serious cases, is the one that requests the process to begin happening. And so you will have a skilled facilitator that begins to facilitate, if not dialogue in the beginning, at least an exchange of information between the victim and the offender. That is a very important process that needs to happen to be able to get people to a position where they can even come to the table. The more they can learn about each other, the easier it's going to be for them to come and sit down. It also is important for the facilitator to have an understanding of whether this is going to be a safe and productive meeting that these folks can have.
So that's in the criminal justice context. But in terms of mediation, something that happens in a junior high school, for instance,
right.
or how does that work? Is it the same? Is it essentially the same process, the same model?
It is exactly the same model in that we sit with individuals privately to begin with to help them understand who we are and for them to understand what they've done and how they can accept responsibility, how they've been hurt, how others have been hurt. We sit down with the other side after we've done that and have basically the same conversation. But in the school cases, we are dealing mostly with conflict. We're dealing with kids who are having conflict with each other, either in their community or within their school. And so I would term that more as conflict resolution than restorative justice, although there are a lot of restorative qualities in there. So it is a different need that we're trying to meet, but the model is almost exactly the same.
We'll find out more about that model, get some examples, and then find out how the project came to Campbell Law School and how it's working out on the state of things when we continue our conversation with John Powell, who runs the Juvenile Justice Project at Campbell University Law School. Conversation continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Law and Order Week, and today we're talking with John Powell, who runs the Juvenile Justice Project at Campbell University Law School. And before the break, we were talking about applying restorative justice techniques and that model to almost a mediation in a mediation context. I wonder if you can give me an example of how it might work or a case that you've actually had, in a juvenile case.
We had a case that came out of the Johnson County school system several years ago when the law school was still located in Harnett County, and we were serving Harnett, Lee, and Johnson County. That was before we had a direct referral program from the high schools, but the example that I'd like to talk about is a high school case, and it is a great illustration of a lot of the casework that we do within middle schools and high schools now. There were two young ladies who had known each other since the eighth grade. When we were referred the case, they were in the 10th grade. They'd been in conflict with each other for 2 years. By the time we got them together, they couldn't even remember why they were in conflict. But there had been many, many hours of school intervention, of family intervention, of time spent on this conflict that these girls had with each other. Until eventually one day, one of them decided she had had all she could take, and she ran toward the bus in the afternoon where the other girl was standing with her back turned to her and attacked her and began assaulting her, began hitting her. They went to the ground. The girl who was attacked got on top of the other girl and got the advantage. And as the one girl's mother explained as she watched it on the videotape, she said she had my daughter by the hair of her head and she was banging her head into the concrete. So this had turned into a very serious situation. Another girl got involved and got this girl off, and so the two began hitting the other girl until the administrators were able to respond and get them apart. And that case was referred to us because they recognized that this had been a long-going dispute, that nothing that had been tried as far as punitive measures had worked, and that something else needed to be brought to the table. And they didn't know a whole lot about this mediation program at the time, but they thought maybe we should give this a shot.
So how does it work? Because I'm guessing, in addition to that, I'm guessing they had been suspended 2 years. They'd
right.
been suspended a couple
right.
of times. They had been, they had seen counselors,
yes.
certainly, that people had
yes.
talked to them. They sat them down, maybe together, maybe apart.
Right.
I mean, all of that had been happening over 2 years. So
right.
what do you do? What process then, how is that process different than what they'd seen already?
Well, it was funny. When I began to talk with them individually about the mediation process, they said, we've already been to mediation. And I said, help me understand what that looked like. And they said, well, the assistant principal brought us in and sat us down and told us if we didn't knock it off, we were going to be out of here.
Mediate this.
Right. I said, well, our program works a lot differently than that. So the way the process works is we meet with the parties individually and privately to begin with. We offer them confidentiality so that they are free to admit their wrongdoing. They are free to accept the appropriate amount of responsibility that they have for the conflict. We ask them to be able to share information between the parties because we realize that that's a very important way to help people finally come to the table and have a safe and productive meeting. So once we get to that point and we feel like we can meet those criteria and the parties are agreeable to do so, we do bring them together to the table.
And you're talking with them separately, just to make that clear. Up until now, separately, exchanging information, you've got permission to do that.
Right.
Now you bring them together.
We bring them together. And we begin by asking them, where is it they want to go that day? Why have you come to the table? What do you need to accomplish today? And I use butcher block paper, and I write those things down on the paper, and we put it up on the wall so everybody can see it. That actually is our destination. If you're going on a trip, you need to know where you're going, so we define that up front. The rest of the day is spent on, okay, how do we get there? And before we end, we check off each of those points of places that they said they wanted to go. One of the important roadmaps to help us get there is to understand how people have been harmed by the behavior. We also write those things down and put those things up on the wall. Once they understand what their needs are and how people have been hurt, it makes it fairly simple to be able to come to a restorative solution.
And what happened in this case?
In this case, we asked them where they wanted to go. They wanted to have the conflict done. They wanted to understand why they had been in conflict. One of the girls had actually left the school on her own because they just did not feel safe to be there anymore. She was being homeschooled at the time. She wanted to go back to school. They both wanted to be able to resume their places on the cheerleading team. That's where we started. Then we do a good bit of humanizing. I think it's critically important that people have a better understanding of who it is that they've been in conflict with. So we talk a lot about their personal lives, their personal situations, things that they love, things that they want to do with their lives. We had their moms in the room, and they were able to do the same thing. We asked their moms what are their dreams for their daughters, and so that can be very powerful. This is all part of the process that leads us to that destination that they've said they want to get to. In this case, it was important for them to understand why they had come into conflict in the first place. And we went back to the eighth grade, and it dealt with the cheerleading squad. And once they understood that, I asked them, I said, how do you feel now understanding why you were in conflict? And you might imagine they said, we feel pretty stupid right now. It was something simple. It was miscommunication. And it's been 2 years of conflict that we've been dealing with. It was interesting, Frank. When we started, generally the mediators will sit on either end of the table, and I usually have a law student with me, and I did in this case. And we'll place the participants across the table from each other. By the end of the day, when we took our last break, when we came back, they chose to sit beside each other instead of across from each other. They were kind enough to let us go back and interview them afterwards, and I use that DVD in a lot of presentation work that I do in helping people see this process.
So how'd they do?
They did wonderfully.
Yeah.
They did wonderfully, and we kept up with them after the mediation process, and they continued to do wonderfully.
Because, John, if you're talking about suspensions, we know that once kids start getting in trouble, the correlation between suspension and contact with the adult criminal justice system is lockstep. The more you're out of school, the more likely you are to be arrested for crime. You're talking about kids in some cases in third grade who are already in this school-to-prison pipeline. It's
right.
For real. So if you can extract them, it seems to me, this is a kind of a good process.
I have a good friend who has worked in behavior support within the school systems, and one of the data points that he likes to use is showing a correlation between the office visit for children and subsequent contact with the criminal justice system. Would it be a good time for me to read a poem that I have in front of me?
Please do.
Lyndon Harris is someone who I have met within the last year, and I think you know Lyndon as well.
Yep, she's Hidden Voices Project.
Worked on a beautiful project. And she sent me a poem that was written by a high school student who had been kicked out of school and was now working on the GED. And it was in response to the theme of what is the opposite of justice. And I just think it beautifully describes the reason that we are working within the school systems. If you got suspended because you and the teacher got into it, when you go back to school, you go right back to the same class with the same people and the same problems. Ain't nothing changed because you're going to turn right back around and do it again. First time they come out of the side of their face at you. Nothing's been worked out. Nope, nothing. You just got suspended. Your problems are still there, and now you're even more mad because you just missed a week or two of school, and everybody there in front of you and the teacher don't want to help you catch up because they say you shouldn't have got suspended. It's the beginning of being left behind. I couldn't have said it that well, Frank, and we want to get in here and help these kids resolve this conflict so they never start down that school-to-prison pipeline. We know that if they're suspended, that could be the beginning of a long cycle for a lot of children.
So tell me a little bit about your childhood growing up in Garner. Did you get in trouble in school?
No, I was a pretty good kid behavior-wise. I was not the best kid academically. I did grow up in Garner. I graduated from Garner Senior High School in 1976. I was one of the younger students in my class, being an October baby, and I went to East Carolina at age 17. Played around down there on my mom and dad's money for about a year until I dropped out. And I was extremely fortunate that I got a terrific job with Carolina Power and Light as a meter reader. So I stomped the pavement for about 5 years in that position and was very happy doing that. Until a few years later, I met a wonderful woman and got married. And her family has a great history of education, as does she. She convinced me that I needed to go back to school, and that's why I went back to NC State, going at night while I was working for Carolina Power and Light during the day. And that was a 10-year process. And there were many times that I wanted to quit. It was just too hard. But my wife was extremely supportive. We had 3 children during that period of time. We had built a house and a life in Fuquay Varina. And it was one of the most rewarding days I've ever had was the day that I graduated from NC State.
I'm going to hear more about that, but I want to go back to ECU when you dropped out. At that moment, did you feel like it was some kind of failure, or did you say, look, this is crazy, school's not for me, and you were perfectly happy to move on? What was going on in your mind when you had to drop out?
I felt like it was a dismal failure, Frank. And I'll tell you what I remember about that. I remember calling my dad and telling him that we had been on this charade long enough and I needed to come home. And he came and got me. And he came and got me in his old DOT pickup truck with the Earl Scheib paint on it that was peeling off. And I remember after we loaded that truck up with my few belongings, riding down that road, looking out at those fields and thinking, I will never have a college degree. I will never have a college degree. And that was a failure to me. But it is amazing as you live life and you stick it out how things can change.
I would think that a memory like that would be so powerful that then, as a guy who's making enough money, got a wife and 3 children,
right,
the memory of the pain you felt leaving the first time might have been enough to keep. How did you even think that you could get through law school? Didn't that scare the heck out of you? It's like, oh, no, not again.
Yeah, going back, it does. Yeah. But it was a calling for me, Frank. I had grown tremendously through my educational experience at NC State. I had grown through my marriage with my wife, Lisa, through having children. And I felt, you know, it's just like the reason we started this program was out of frustration with the status quo. And I had become frustrated that I couldn't give and do the things that I felt like I was really put on the earth to do. And so I began looking at graduate programs first. And one thing led to another. I had a professor at State that put the notion of law school in my mind. I began to investigate that and began to think this is something that really could happen.
What were those things that you felt you were put on this earth to do?
I think I began to understand that we are gifted as followers of Christ. I began to understand that I had some gifts. I think I have the gift of encouragement. I was able to lead a small group adult Sunday school class in my church in Fuquay. Began to realize that I could facilitate groups and help people be reflective on their own lives and things that they could do. And all of those things just came together. I didn't really think about the rigors of law school. I'll tell you right now, after having gone through it, nobody understands before you do it what law school is really like. Mm-hmm. It is the most rigorous thing I have ever done in my life. I don't know how I got through it, Frank, but I did get through it. Perseverance and hard work and my wife especially giving me a lot of support and encouragement.
Well, that's interesting. It does sound like your personal faith and your religious faith played a big part in your awakening, your sense that you had a bigger responsibility?
I think it did. And so I never even considered the challenges. I just felt like I was being led to do it, and I had an obligation to do it. And I wanted to do it. I wanted to develop my gifts and my calling and try to make a difference in the world. And that is something that's a mission of our law school. We want students to see the profession as a calling to help other people. And so that's the way that I counsel my students today.
Well, it's interesting to think about that and what was going through your mind, the idea that you've got this gift, I can counsel, I'll go, I'll get a law degree, I've got it. Now I'm working with these kids. Here I am, I'm in a perfect position to help them. It's not working out.
Right.
But you didn't give up, and you found out, you looked into restorative justice or heard about it, and then got it instituted at Campbell. How did that come about, to get this project and clinic at Campbell?
Right. I was talking about my friend Tony Baker a moment ago. It was his dream to have a clinic. I never even considered a clinic. But my passion for the criminal law and for mediation, and his passion to begin a clinic, and his experience in seeing this work in other parts of the world, were the two things that came together that enabled us to do it. We started that conversation in a seminar one day that we were both attending. We continued that conversation over lunch over the next few weeks. And then we decided we needed to meet with our chief district court judge. And we met with him. And either ironically or divinely, he was already working on a court improvement program for the juvenile court within our district. And so this notion that we had of creating a clinic where we could allow juveniles to come in and take responsibility for what they've done and do things to make things right with people they have offended against made an awful lot of sense to him, Judge Ed McCormick. I still see him from time to time, and I have a great deal of respect for him. We then took the idea to our dean, Willis Wichard, at the time, and he also liked the idea an awful lot. And he said, I'm all for it as long as it doesn't cost us anything, right? So we put together a task force, and that was at the direction of the judge. And over about the next year and a half, we investigated how we could do it. We found money through the Governor's Crime Commission. We received a grant from them, and we started the clinic.
So how many cases do you get in a year?
In a year, we have averaged about 60. But I'll tell you, this year we have already exceeded that number. Mm-hmm. So we'll probably go to 80 cases this year.
And these are law students who are mostly taking these cases with your supervision, I guess?
Exactly. Law students take my class in the fall. They learn about the retributive system. I think it's critical that they understand about the current system first, so they have that backdrop on which to hold up restorative justice and see it more clearly. So we teach them about retributive justice. We teach them about restorative justice. We teach them the skill set that they need to begin to facilitate this dialogue. They have observation requirements as a part of what they do during the classroom portion. They work closely with me in mediating these cases, and then they begin to work either with me or with their we pair them up with other students, and they begin to facilitate these live cases.
And about how many students are in the clinic?
I'll have 22 on my roster this semester. I'll have probably about 20 students in the clinic next spring. And one of the beautiful things, Frank, about this is these folks graduate and become lawyers. And so now they have a philosophy and a view that can really help them see their clients as human beings and really help them solve problems instead of buying into a notion that we have created systems to solve problems for people. I think our students can go out there and work with their clients so that their clients can begin to solve their own problems.
Are they lawyers or are they anti-lawyers? And I don't mean this in the most cynical way, but it does seem if you have an adversarial system that you're talking against the system and you're actually talking a kind of blasphemy. Is there a way that the legal profession can see itself doing this work, still maintaining its profession and turning out good, good lawyers? Or is it a threat to the profession? You're talking about the anti-law.
Well, it depends on what your perspective of lawyers is. And my perspective of lawyers is that the very best lawyering that we can do is to help our clients solve their own problems. I think most lawyers will tell you that they want to avoid litigation if they can. They want to avoid their client having to go before a judge if they can. They want to empower their clients as much as possible to be able to solve their own problems. I think that's what most lawyers would say to you. I think that's the very best of the profession. So I hope that there are lawyers that will listen to this show and go, yeah, I get that. I understand that. That is the best of what we can do.
We'll talk more about this system, restorative justice, and its possibilities in the adult system as my conversation with John Powell continues. Law and Order Week is underway, and we'll be back after a short break on the State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. John Powell is my guest today, director of the Juvenile Justice Project at Campbell University Law School. And we talked about, John, your effort with others to bring the clinic to Campbell Law School. They didn't see it as a direct threat to the profession, as long as it didn't cost them any money. Okay. What about the school system? How open are they to this process?
Our program began in Harnett County as a resource for the criminal justice system. But it became apparent to me pretty quickly that a lot of the cases that were being referred to us were occurring within the schools. So we began to talk to the school systems in Harnett, helping them understand who we were and what we could do. And in the beginning, it was a notion that was not very attractive. However, when the information filtered down to counselors and social workers, it made an awful lot of sense to them. And I think just because of the training and background and the kind of work that they do every day, they understood it. And so we had one high school that began to use us, and it was wildly successful. From that, word of mouth spread it to other high schools and middle schools within the county. Not too long, though, after we were up and running with them, the law school made a decision that it was going to move from Buies Creek to Raleigh. So we transferred everything that we were doing to Wake County, and we began as a resource for the Wake County juvenile court system, but we also immediately began with the Wake County school system. And that was largely because we had friends already in Wake County that knew about what we were doing. They were very, very supportive of what we were doing, and we were put in touch with Karen Hamilton that works within the Wake County school system. And she has a lot of experience with the population of kids that we work with. She was very excited about it. She went and talked to a few of her principals who bought into it. So we started very slowly. We started with Moore Square Middle School downtown, mostly because of their need and our proximity to them. And then we began working with Ligon Middle School, which was downtown as well. By the end of this next semester, we will be working with 8 Wake County schools, and I am extremely excited about that because as a defense attorney, one of my notions in the beginning was to do anything we could to keep a child from ever touching the criminal justice system. And so we are making an impact in helping these kids not have the contact, and we also are making an impact such that the schools do not have to suspend these children.
Are you keeping any statistics? Because it seems to me we've got, again, the figures on the number of times you're suspended and how quickly you'll come in contact with criminal justice are pretty keen. We can see those. So then your case is, you know, if kids turn out all right, might be a significant demonstration.
We have kept data since the beginning of the program, but most especially when we were working on grant money because we had to report that to the grant funder. And when we were working cases in the Harnett County school system, we kept that data as well. Typically ranged recidivism rates of 15% or less, which if you look at recidivism rates across the board, that's a very low number. Since we've been in Raleigh, we have kept recidivism rates on our court cases, and they have stayed pretty much in that range. I don't have data on the Wake County school system. We have only been working here for 3 years and really in limited capacity for those 3 years. But I think just like when we were keeping data before, once we cross about a 5-year mark, I think we can have significant data to share. However, anecdotally, we know that it does make a difference. Every principal that we work with raves about the differences that they see in the behavior, and they know that it is helping them. And so they continue to invite us to come back every year. And it is expanding within Wake County.
There have to be cases where this doesn't work, right?
There are cases where it doesn't work. The most significant cases in my mind are where the offender has no remorse about what they've done. They don't care about doing the right thing. They don't have a notion that they have hurt anybody by doing this. And when I see that happening, I just say to them, I'm sorry that you feel that way. this program is not for you, because you need to have a notion of how this has hurt you and others. You need to want to claim some responsibility and do something better than what you're doing. And so we closed the case at that point in time. And when that happens, Frank, we just simply send that case back to the referring party, and then they use their discretion to do whatever they do. And I often tell a child, once you are tired of the system beating you over the head, if you decide that we might be a better resource for you, we will always be here.
It seems to me, though, that that leaves you open. When you say that, this charge of a kind of cheap grace, and, oh, I know, all I have to do is go apologize to these guys, and then I'm off the hook.
Right.
Simple.
And we maintained the discretion within the local rules to be able to not accept cases and not continue in cases. And it's easy to see when somebody is just looking for cheap grace. It's equally powerful and easy to see when people are not looking for cheap grace and they want to work through this process, which, by the way, is a very difficult thing for an offender to sit with a person that they've offended against and look them in the eye and listen to them and make an apology and try to accept responsibility. So we don't dispense cheap grace. It's a difficult process for kids to go through.
It's interesting that you say that in some small – is it a small fraction of cases where you find people just have no remorse and they can't go through? So in that small fraction where there is no remorse, no sign of remorse, it's not going to work. So often in criminal cases, you'll hear the defendant, he showed no remorse. He did all these awful things. And yet the system insists on that, doesn't it?
You must
insist on your innocence. You're not going to give away your hand with a show of remorse in the courtroom if you've been told by your attorney you didn't do it and you're going to stick to that.
Right. That's exactly right. That's a design of the system. That is a valid design of the system, because if you admit, you have the weight of the state that comes down against you. And so any defense attorney worth their salt is going to tell you that you maintain, at least you do not admit guilt, you don't talk about it. One of the things that hurt me, Frank, as a defense attorney, would be to stand with my client at the plea stage or at the end of a trial where they were found guilty, and for the judge to ask my client at the end of that if there was anything that they wanted to say to the victims. I cringe, because there is nothing that they can say at that point in time that can be heard and that can be helpful to anyone. And so I would encourage my client, even at that point, not to make a comment. The only way for that to be meaningful is if we have entered into dialogue, if we have had an opportunity to see each other differently, and that victim understands that what is being said is genuine, and then it can be meaningful and it can lead in the healing process, but not until that happens.
So you think this process can be useful in the adult system?
Sure. I mean, we don't have it in our adult system in North Carolina. I certainly am an advocate for that. And a big part of what I try to do in my daily work is to help others learn more about and understand about restorative justice. I have seen this work in other states, even in murder cases. As a matter of fact, one of the ways that I was hooked into this was watching a documentary film where a woman named Linda White met with a man named Gary Brown in Texas after Gary had been involved in abducting, raping, and murdering Linda's daughter, Kathy O'Daniel. And 11 or 12 years later, Linda had learned about this process that, believe it or not, Texas had set up so that people could sit down and have this conversation. And she did have this conversation, and it was done within a documentary, and it's one of the most powerful things that I have ever seen. So I saw the healing process that this can have. Since then, I have a good friend named Therese Bartholomew who went through this process in South Carolina with the man that killed her brother. Mm-hmm. We have had requests from people within North Carolina for me to help them in facilitating this dialogue, and I have said yes to that. And so I have had meetings with prisoners as they are in prison serving life sentences to be able to simply exchange information with a surviving victim family member who has questions that only that person that committed the murder can answer. And it can be a very powerful thing. So I'm hoping, Frank, that as we move forward, that creating victim-offender dialogue, even in the most heinous of cases within North Carolina, is something that we will be able to do.
Well, tell me more about your experience in the adult system. Why does, because these cases come to you at the initiation of the victim's family, right?
That's correct.
Why, in a murder case, would the sister or the mother of a murder victim want to meet with the person who committed the crime?
In one of the cases where a lady came to me and asked me if I could help her meet with a man that had been convicted of killing her sister, I asked her that question. I said, when I make this request of him, and when I also make this request of the superintendent of the prison, their question is going to be, why in the world does she want to meet with this person? So I asked her if she would write a letter to the man. And if she would put within that letter, why does she want to meet with him? And there can be a myriad of reasons, but most of her reasons were because she needed information. Her sister had been murdered in a parking lot near NC State University back in 1975. There was a trial, but it was tried about 8 years after the fact. It was completely a circumstantial case. She did not learn a whole lot about the details because the law enforcement didn't have a lot about the details. She wanted to know what the details were. So within her letter, one thing that she said was, why did a purse snatching turn into murder? She wanted to know if he had thought about who the lady's family members might have been. Had he thought about what people had gone through since he had taken the life of someone that they had loved? These are questions that, especially the questions about what happened and why, that only the person that has committed the crime can answer.
And why would they want to answer those questions?
Why would the offender want to answer those questions? The offenders that I have spoken with are remorseful about what they have done. They have admitted what they have done. They don't find that they can be very productive within the prison system. So they are looking for a way to be productive. They want to answer the question because they want to do what they can to try to help someone that they understand they have hurt. And quite frankly, they will never understand it the way that they will understand it by entering into this victim-offender dialogue process, because they will get all the intimate details about the people that they have hurt, and they can do something even from the prison walls that can be productive.
I have to say I'm extremely interested personally in this process, and have worked with you and met with you a number of times with people from the Religious Coalition for a Nonviolent Durham in talking about ways to possibly bring this process to the Durham, certainly the juvenile system, maybe the court system. How does it work? And been in on those meetings, and I'd like you to share a little bit about the process. How do you get it started in a region, and what's the resistance? Why, you know, who is there an objection to this, and what are those objections?
I think there's an objection mainly because it sounds so foreign to what we have always known. We were joking around a little bit before we came in today that 10 years ago, I was beating on doors trying to get people to listen to me about restorative justice, and I would talk about it, and they'd look at me like I had a horn growing out of my head. Now people are beginning to understand that it is a very human process, and it meets a very human need. And so people are more than willing to hear. They're inviting us to come in and talk about this. But I think initially, when you have not heard of anything other than a retributive system, there's some resistance because this sounds so foreign, and it is a strange concept to get your head around when you're talking about bringing victims and offenders together. But once you begin to understand that there is a deliberate process that has been put in place to keep people safe, to protect what people have to say, to let them be very human with each other, and it is a facilitated dialogue, and it is not one where people are immediately brought together, they are prepared to do that, people begin to understand that this can be a very positive thing. In order to get things started, I think you need to have some sympathetic ears. We had that within our jurisdiction, both in the criminal system and in the school systems. And I say this, I said this to a class that I taught in Asheville last week to people that are interested in doing this. I don't go through walls, I walk around them. And that is to say, I don't fight the battles. I go where I think people can hear this and people can be responsive. And so my advice to people that want to start is to try to do that.
What's your vision for the future and restorative justice? Do you see it as a replacement for retributive justice, something in equilibrium, or, you know, sort of always an appendage? How do you see it in the future?
I don't see it as a replacement for our current legal system. I won't live long enough to see that, and I don't even know if that's a goal that we should have. I think our current legal system does an awful lot of good things, and I think that some people do need to be incarcerated. I do think, though, that we can meet victims' needs by using restorative practices. So right now, Frank, I like to see us coming alongside our current system and trying to meet needs that the current system simply is not designed to meet. Let it be victim-driven. Let it focus on the harm that's being done and how we can repair that harm. I think that especially within our schools, it can be a culture-changing theory of justice. Even now in the schools that we've been in for a while, students don't wait for us to be called. They will go to their administrator and they will say things like, will you call those people from Campbell and get them to come over here and help us mediate our conflict? That's a really beautiful thing.
John, pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
John Powell is director of the Juvenile Justice Project at Campbell University Law School. Thanks for listening to The State of Things today. You can go to our website, stateofthings.org. You can hear archived editions of past programs, find links to any events we mention on the show. Our program is produced by Alex Granados and Sean Wen. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.